Before we start this podcast, we would like to take the opportunity to mention that we now have a Patreon page where you can help to support, evolve and continue these compassionate conversations. Please visit patreon.com/vocedialogues for more information. Listen!
Welcome everyone to the Voce Dialogues, Voices of Compassionate Evolution. I'm Chloe Goodchild, founder of The Naked Voice, and this is our new online community where we are exploring, deepening, and evolving our awareness of the transforming power of compassion. Enjoy these new dialogues with a wide range of artists, musicians, writers and philosophers, social entrepreneurs and sacred activists. They are all visionaries, transforming lives through the art of conscious creative expression with practices inspired by their own unique life experience. The Voce Dialogues are dedicated to the compassionate evolution of life on Earth. Well, greetings, everyone, and it's my great joy and pleasure to be with a very dear friend, John Stuart Reed. Hello, John.
Hello, Chloe. This is really wonderful. I'm so glad that you thought of inviting me to you today. It's going to be a fun interview, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great joy that you're here, particularly at this moment in the course of history, because I think the work and the research and the work that you are really bringing out into the world at this time regarding the healing power of sound and so on is absolutely imperative. So I just feel very, very honored to be in this conversation with you. And for those of you that are listening, I just love to share a little bit about you, John, with those that perhaps don't know the kind of detail of your background and life story. John Stuart Reed is an acoustic physics scientist with a mission to educate, to inspire, and excite the world in the field of visible sound, known to science as Faraday wave phenomena, but popularly known as cymatics. John points out that since sound was a potent force in the creation of life in the primordial oceans, sound, therefore, carries the power to heal life. In his frequent lectures, he reveals groundbreaking information on the mechanisms that underpin sound therapy and music medicine, and how it can be applied to improve health naturally. My goodness, don't we just need to know about that? John's career in acoustics has spanned 5 decades, and he's widely acknowledged as an authority in cymatic science, speaking on this subject at conferences in Europe and across America. His cymoscope invention has changed our perception of sound forever. Seeing sound allows us to understand this omnipresent aspect of our world and the universe fuller and deeper. In 2021, John was invited by a European Union initiative to write a chapter for a new medical textbook on sound therapy and music medicine, a mission to begin building bridges between mainstream medicine and integrative medicine. A mission that continues to this day and from here on after. So, John, I mean, I absolutely bow to your work, to what you're doing and to what you're bringing through for not just, you know, really highly sophisticated scientists and people who are working in this groundbreaking field of which you are a pioneer, but for ordinary people to understand, you know, we've had many of us have had this experience of what's called sound therapy, sound healing, loosely called sound medicine. And for many people, of course, that would mean lying down, resting and listening to, you know, the beautiful sounds of singing bells and gongs and so on. And to just really be in an absorptive state in relation to those sounds. And many people, of course, have been delivering this for a few decades now. And that's been really, really beneficial for everyone. And then, of course, there's the people like the work that Eileen McCusick is doing and others in the field of music medicine. I'm thinking of Christine Stevens as well, whose work with rhythm and so on, which has really been very instrumental in helping people to understand, you know, the entrainment dimension of sound work and so on. I've been very blessed to know about your work for really quite some time and very lucky to be invited into. I remember that moment on Chesil Beach down in Dorset in that old church. I think, was it one of the oldest churches in England? I'm not sure.
I don't think it's particularly old, but it is a Templar church, or at least many people attribute that church. It's St. Catherine's Chapel, isn't it?
There you go.
St. Catherine's Chapel, and it is a Templar related structure. At least many people believe that. But yeah, that's a beautiful acoustic in there, Chloe. Oh my goodness.
Fascinating. And I remember arriving there in a howling gale. I was in massive winds going on outside, and the chapel was absolutely rock solid. To find you and a group of other, you know, diverse group of vocalists, and you were in the perhaps earlier stages of really developing your technology and so on, and inviting us to sing, and, you know, really just showing us in these initial stages how sound becomes visible. So that's my treasured memory of the first meeting with you.
In that chapel, if you recall, the very, very early version of the cymoscope instrument that, you know, that I was developing at that time was basically a large drum with a membrane stretched across, literally a PVC membrane stretched across the top of this drum, put to a specific tension. And then in this drum were some small speakers, some small transducers. Yeah. And then we would sprinkle sand, literally sand, on the membrane. And then you would sing your beautiful vocalizations and watch the sand dance and move, you know, as if by some unseen force. Well, there is an unseen force, of course, it's the force of sound. Yeah. But it's moving those sand grains into a beautiful pattern. Because, you know, with the science of cymatics, whenever there's beauty present, and it certainly was with your gorgeous voice, then it manifests in beautiful geometry. And with the cymoscope instrument that we have today, which is a very different technology to what you saw all those years ago, nevertheless, the same principle applies, that beauty in equals beauty out. So in other words, whatever beautiful harmonic sounds we inject into the cymoscope instrument, what we see is what we would term beauty, because it just is. You know, humans have this propensity for, they love beauty. And that's what we see whenever we make a beautiful sound visible with the cymoscope instrument.
It was absolutely captivating. I have never forgotten that. And the fact that you had such a diversity of vocalists there. And I know there's somebody coming in more recently. Is it Lucy up in Stroud? She's a scholar of Sanskrit. I'm going to be fascinated to hear more about that, whether there's a chance that her deliberation of sounds and the vibration of sounds and so on, what impact that will have on the technology and so on. But it was a memorable day. It really was. And I think what it really brought home to me was the way in which your work is really collapsing the dimensions between spirituality and sound and science. And that really brings me to the question of compassion itself, which is, if you like, is the theme of this conversation, and how your work, how your life has given voice to compassion. What is compassion? What does it mean for you, and how has it shown up in your life?
Gosh, Chloe, you know, it's a question that I've never ever been asked, but it's a really good question. I think I would say, to begin with, that one has to have, well, I know, let's speak for myself. I have to have compassion for myself. Why? Because, you know, I'm like any other human being. I've experienced great pain, great sadness in my life. For example, you know, when my parents passed, and then just 2 years ago, when my beloved sister passed, we were just so close as a family. And when anyone in your family passes, of course, it really is a great pain. I have compassion for myself, obviously, you know, whenever anything of that ilk happens in my life, experience great pain. So one has to have, I have to have compassion for myself. And then in my work, if I can just take a step back to where my work really began in terms of sound therapy and music medicine and so on, because the genesis of all of that began in the Great Pyramid before you and I met, you know, in St. Catherine's Chapel. So going right back now to 1997, and maybe some of your listeners already know this story, but, you know, for those who don't, just a very quick, broad brush kind of explanation.
Yeah, fantastic, yep.
My daddy and I had traveled in Egypt many times. Actually, we considered ourselves to be kind of amateur Egyptologists. We were fascinated by the craftsmanship, the sheer devotional love that these people had put into their works of art and even into their building of their monuments. So daddy and I were really, really fascinated by all of that. And we traveled many times in Egypt. But on this particular occasion, very early in 97, I think it was February, we found ourselves in the Great Pyramid without anyone else present. And we hadn't planned it, Chloe. It was just one of those wonderful moments that occur, happenstance moments, lucky accident, basically. And anyway, because we were alone in the King's Chamber, you know, for those of you who have not been in that amazing space, it is highly reverberant, even more so than St. Catherine's Chapel. Wow. It has a very long reverberation time. The walls, the floor, the ceiling, they're all made from rose granite, which comes from Aswan, hundreds of miles to the south in Egypt. I'd always believed that the Egyptians had chosen this rose, this pink granite, for a specific purpose. And this particular day, because we were all alone, I got my wish to lie in the sarcophagus, which is a box of granite. So it would have started life as a solid monolithic block of granite that the Egyptians then hollowed out. And that is no mean feat, I can tell you. It's really, you know, a very, very, very hard rock. In this particular case, it's 3.7 tons in its hollowed out state. And the side walls of the sarcophagus are highly resonant to mechanical movement, basically. So if you take the side of your fist and literally just tap the side of this sarcophagus anywhere, it creates this beautiful low-pitched sound. It's really a gorgeous, it's like striking a bell, basically, but a very, very low-pitched bell. And it's very harmonic, the sound. So not just a single tone that you hear, but many different frequencies, and they seem to be harmonic to the ear. It's a very pleasant sound. Anyway, you know, at that time in my career, I actually wasn't an acoustic scientist. I was an acoustics engineer. So And I was running my own acoustics consultancy business, and so naturally, you know, my whole world was sound even then. And so I wanted to lie in the sarcophagus when no one was looking. It's a bit naughty, you know, but many people have done that, I'm sure, over the years, probably millions, actually. Anyway, I lay in the sarcophagus and I performed a very simple vocal glissando. And its purpose was so that I could assess the approximate prime resonant frequency of that sarcophagus. Because when you make sound, as you I'm sure you know, and everyone knows when they make sound in their bathroom, how it sounds so much different to, you know, making sound in their living room, for example, because of the hard surfaces and so on. Anyway, when you make sound, when anyone makes sound in a small chamber, then very specific, what are called modes, frequency modes occur. And these are places in the spectrum of sound where the sound reflects off the surfaces right back at you, but in a very, very dynamic and kind of maximal way. These are called the prime modes or the prime resonant frequency of that particular space. So you could do this in your own bathroom, you know, make a vocal glissando, stand there, close your eyes, and listen, and you will hear one particular frequency or pitch, we should really call it, where the sound is much louder. And that's what I did, you know, lying in the sarcophagus all those years ago.
Interesting. But
one particular pitch, every cell in my body suddenly felt like it was tingling, and goosebumps broke out all over my flesh, you know, and I could feel these kind of what felt like waves of energy rushing up and down my spine. And it was an amazing moment. And of course, at that point in my career, Chloe, I think I'd probably been an acoustics engineer about 25 years at that point, and had never experienced anything even remotely like that. So, of course, you know, I became very excited, and, you know, just a few minutes later jumped out and, you know, chatted with my dad about it, who was also an engineer, by the way. And what we came to consider was that the Egyptians had somehow contrived this effect. You know, they'd gone to a lot of trouble to quarry this granite in Aswan. They could have used limestone, but they didn't. They chose, you know, one of the hardest stones that you can ever quarry. And they chose that for a very specific purpose. Now, what was that purpose? In the end, you know, to cut a very long story short, believe that the purpose was an acoustics purpose. So anyway, again, trying to sort of truncate this story, because I know we don't have a lot of time, I pretty much there and then decided I must know the truth of this. I must, you know, come back armed with acoustics instrumentation and find out why I had experienced that amazing effect. Mm-hmm. And it brought tears to my eyes, by the way, as well. It wasn't just a physical effect. It was an emotional, spiritual connection that I felt in that space. I mean, it is a sacred space. And yes. My dad was very respectful. He was standing there very quiet and just watching me do my thing. Anyway, so there were tears in my eyes, you know, and we had this lovely chat later in the hotel. There and then decided that I must come back with instrumentation, which I did. Mm-hmm. So I managed to obtain permission. And then the same year, I went back again. I'm going to have to cut this very short, I know. Where I want to skip to is when I came back to conduct a cymatics experiment, which involved stretching a membrane across the open top of that same sarcophagus. And this time, instead of me lying in that sarcophagus making sound, the plan was to put a small speaker in there and to make sound through that speaker from an electronic oscillator. So very similar to my vocal sounds, but this time, you know, created electronically. Mm-hmm. But 3 weeks before going out to Egypt to conduct these cymatics experiments, I injured my lower back quite badly, and I was in a lot of pain. You know, I'm a tall, slim guy, and I just did something. Well, I actually had been overworking, Chloe, and I was very tired, and I bent down at an awkward angle to lift something, very silly. And, you know, oh my goodness, the pain was extreme. It actually seemed to tighten up. The more I tried to work through it, the worse it became. And I was literally in agony for those 3 weeks, you know, before going out to Egypt. And at one point I thought, I don't know whether I can do this. I think I might have to cancel. But the Egyptian authorities had taken a lot of money off me. So I just kind of gritted my teeth, and I was popping ibuprofen pills like they were M&Ms or something, probably far too many of them, you know, to try to just mask the pain.
Yes.
To cope with it, basically. Because, you know, and I'm sure that many listeners have had similar experiences where when we have really severe pain, it's like it just fills our whole consciousness. We can't think of anything else. Mm. Anyway, so I took probably overdose on ibuprofen. And in the end, somehow, I managed to get myself into the pyramid. Other people carried in the equipment and set up this experiment. Well, you know, the antiquities inspector, I think, I'm pretty sure he thought I was a loony, you know, just crazy man. Because, you know, I was doing something really extraordinary here. You know, an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus, stretching a membrane across the top, putting a little speaker in the bottom, sprinkling on sand, which, by the way, we had collected from outside the pyramid, because they've got any amount of sand.
Brilliant.
You know, and then switching on the oscillator. And then, you know, starting with this very, very low pitched tone, about 50 hertz, which was about as low as this little speaker could go. And then, you know, watching the sand grains, and all this time being in absolute agony, basically. I was, you know, sweat pouring out of me. I was in such pain. And then, and the reason I'm coming to the point of all of this, by the way, you know, there is a point to me telling this story, and I'll get to it in a moment. So what then happened was absolutely extraordinary, because just as I was increasing the amplitude a little bit, so this is the volume of the sound, and then just tweaking the frequency a little bit on the oscillator, so maybe, you know, sort of 50, 51 hertz. And what we do when looking at cymatics from a particulate matter point of view, when you've got literally, in this case, sand on a membrane, what we need to do is to be very careful to increase the amplitude to only just enough so we can start to see a little movement in the sand grains, right? And they start to dance. And then I tweak the frequency just a little bit and see if it maximizes the you know, the amount they're dancing, just a little tiny bit. So it's a very kind of fine-tuned type of thing. Anyway, at this particular frequency, the very first frequency that I tried, and what then happened was so extraordinary, because an ancient Egyptian hieroglyph suddenly emerged in the sand. I mean, it was the most extraordinary moment in my life, actually. You know, and this amazing hieroglyph was not stationary. It was not static. It was snaking. And this was actually the backbone of the god Osiris. This is called the Djed pillar. And it's, you know, symbolizes, let's say, the backbone of the god Osiris. And when this happened, the antiquity inspector who was standing up against the north wall, filing his nails and looking across at me, and the gaze that seemed to say, "You are a crazy man, but I don't care, because you've paid a lot of money and, you know, it's not doing any harm to the sarcophagus, so get on with it." But when this happened, he rushed across the chamber from where he was standing, dropped his nail file, and suddenly he just stared with his eyes wide open and his hands splayed. You know, he was, oh my goodness, he was in shock. How you do that? You know, he really, because he recognized, the same as I did, you know, what this was.
Yes.
And oh my goodness, what a moment it was. Anyway, so now he wanted to be engaged. He wanted, "How can I help you? What can I do?" You know, so I said, "Well, you can help to scrape the sand off, because, you know, it's necessary when we're doing these kind of experiments to scrape off the sand. It's quite a large area, that sarcophagus, you know." Mm-hmm. Anyway, scrape it off and then sprinkle on fresh sand, and then tune a new frequency and see what happens. Well, almost every time we change the frequency, a new hieroglyph would appear, a completely different hieroglyph, right? I mean, it was extraordinary. And after about 20 minutes of making sound, I suddenly realized, and this is the point, that all the pain in my back had left me. No pain whatsoever, right?
Oh my
goodness. And this was such an amazing feeling for me at that time, to realize that the pain that I'd had for 3 solid weeks was banished completely. And in that moment, Chloe, I thought, I know what this is. Endorphins are running in my bloodstream, because I was so excited. I was so happy and amazed, quite honestly. I mean, who wouldn't be?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I thought, I know what's going to happen here. I will get back outside the pyramid, get back to the hotel, and then suddenly this pain is going to come back like a wall and hit me. Mm. But the pain never did come back, Chloe. In fact, I was so pain-free, I was able to, at the end of the experiment, start to, you know, break it down and literally help to carry out all this heavy equipment without any pain whatsoever, right?
Sure.
So it was like a miracle had occurred, you know, it was miraculous, let's say, for sure.
Yes.
And so that really, really got my attention. Well, the 2 things here are important to say. The first to say is that clearly something miraculous had happened here with my lower back, right? I mean, to be in pain for 3 weeks and then just 20 minutes of low frequency sound, and it was mainly low frequencies, by the way, Chloe.
I see.
Had completely banished the pain. So that really got my attention, obviously.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was that this cymatics experiment had been so phenomenally successful. How was it that ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs had appeared in the sand that day? You know, what was the mechanism? Where did they originate from? That really also got my attention. And so, again, cutting this story very short, the result of all of that was that I saw a future for me in which there would be answers to the question of how had my back been healed in 20 minutes. Yes. And then I also saw a future in which cymatics would become a new science for the 21st century, you know, which was not far away at that particular time, 1997. And that's basically, you know, how my life changed, because literally I went back home after that research and started making plans to sell my acoustics consultancy business, which I eventually did in 1999, 2 years later. And then switch roles, you know, from being an acoustics engineer to being an acoustics scientist. And that's what I've been all of these years since then. And of course, the result is two things. First of all, we now have a beautiful cymoscope instrument, not using particulate matter, of course, anymore. But, you know, I very quickly found out that that was not the way to make sound visible if we want a great amount of detail, which I knew was important from a scientific viewpoint. The way that eventually the instrument as it is now uses only pure, very, very pure medical grade water. This is the kind of water that you can inject into your veins quite safely, you know, so it's beautiful, pure, pure water. Right. And that is the way that sound is made visible, by injecting sound into that pure water. And then the sounds literally organize all the trillions and trillions of molecules in that water in an instant. I mean, in a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, suddenly all those molecules are beautifully organized by the harmonic sounds that we're injecting in, whether they be vocal sounds, Chloe, you know, or whatever.
Oh my goodness.
So that's, you know, that was obviously one aspect of my research all those years. But also the other one, of course, is that I now have many of the answers, not all, of course, but I have many of the answers as to how sound and indeed music trigger the body's healing response. And I should say quickly at this point that it's important for listeners to understand, realize that only the body can heal. You know, I'm not really in favor, quite honestly, of this term sound healing. I think it's a bit of a challenging term, because it's suggesting that sound is actually doing the healing. And in reality, it's not. You know, sound is actually the catalyst, let's call it. It's a way of supporting the body's own natural healing, you know, our own innate ability to heal. We simply need the vibrational support for that to happen. So I prefer to use the term sound therapy. If we're talking about applications where specific sound, single frequencies perhaps are used, like for example with Eileen McCusick's tuning forks, you know, or Geraldine Bowles' crystal bowls, this type of, you know, where you've got pure sounds, very pure sounds. Yeah. I would classify that as sound therapy.
Right.
But then when we talk about music, of course, then we have this new clinical term now, music medicine. And I think this is a wonderful thing that happened in our world, Chloe, that the mainstream medicine has actually embraced, or is beginning, let's say, to embrace music as medicine.
Oh,
that's a wonderful, wonderful start to changing the way that medicine works, actually, because it is drug-free. You can't overdose on music, and yet music has so many healing attributes, you know. And this is part has been a large part of my journey these last 20 years, understanding those biological mechanisms. Now, some of your listeners would probably be thinking right now, well, why do we need to know? You know, isn't it just important to know that it does heal? Well, there's some truth in that, in, you know, one aspect, one sense of it. But the reason that, from my perspective, the reason that it is so important to actually understand the biological mechanisms is because I believe that mainstream medicine will never embrace music as medicine. They'll never embrace specific sound frequencies as medicine until the biological mechanisms are understood, right? They have to understand that, at least have some kind of a, you know, working hypothesis, or actually understand it from a much deeper theoretical point of view. So that's reason. You know, I reasoned this out many, many years ago. So you can imagine now how happy I am, you know, to know that music is now being embraced as medicine in mainstream hospitals. Not all hospitals yet, of course, but it is starting to happen in the medical literature. This term, music medicine, is starting to be seen more and more. And it's a wonderful thing that's happening, Chloe.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's really, really very exciting. But what I'm very interested about is the connection between the individual and the sound and the revelation of the healing process, and what part the individual, perhaps also involved, is required to play, if you like, in terms of interacting with this understanding.
Absolutely. And just before we talk about that, Chloe, I'm sorry to say that I forgot to come back to your question, actually, which was about compassion. You know, I mentioned about compassion for myself, obviously, you know, love of self, which I think is a very, very important aspect of being human, because if we don't love ourselves and don't have compassion for ourselves, how can we possibly love other people and have compassion for other people? So that's obviously very, very important. Yeah. But then, again, many years ago, even, you know, when I was just coming out of the pyramid all those years ago, 97, I had this vision that if I could be healed in 20 minutes by, you know, simply low frequency sound, immersing myself in low frequency sound, then I saw this vision in which there was a future where vibrational medicine, let's call it, you know, as a kind of umbrella term.
Yes.
Vibrational medicine would be the future for humanity, and having compassion for all the people who were, I hate to use this term, but, you know, kind of drugs are poisons, basically. You know, I know that some drugs are really essential, so I'm not knocking mainstream medicine, you know, in terms of the drugs that are really, really essential. Antibiotics, for example, can save so many lives. And we know that mainstream medicine has some wonderful tools. If you have a faulty heart or some other organ that can be replaced these days by transplants, and if we have any kind of acute problem with our body, then mainstream medicine is superb. But its limitation is when we're talking about chronic illness. Chronic illness, mainstream medicine has almost nothing to offer people that have chronic illness. Right. And yet, here, you know, there was a situation where I think it would probably even today be classified as chronic pain. Even 3 weeks of severe pain would probably be classed as chronic. I'm not sure about that. But
I would say.
Anyway, the point was, you know, that I had been to my GP, you know, in those days, and what can you offer me? Well, ibuprofen, you know, or if you can take paracetamol or whatever. In other words, they had actually nothing that they could offer me that would take this pain away. And let's be honest, you know, pain is a necessary component of illness, of injury. Let's say in this case, you have to have pain. It's an automatic response of the body. In my case, of course, I was needing to do something with my body that was extraordinary, you know, crawling into a pyramid.
Right.
And so this is why I needed to mediate the pain. You know, I needed help, basically, because I couldn't do my job otherwise. Yeah. But nevertheless, pain is an important aspect. You know, inflammation is an important aspect of the healing process. But now, you know, if we want to talk about this in terms of the compassion, I saw this future, Chloe, where I had compassion for all of humanity who were taking, probably like I did in those days, way too many, you know, analgesics to try to just get through the pain. And people, I've seen so many people in my own family who have a whole string of medications. You take this medication for something or other, And then when you have a side effect from that one, you take another one that helps to get rid of that side effect or helps to mediate it. And then you take another one and it just goes on and on and on. And some people are being drugged very often with way too many medications.
But it's that whole sort of culture of passivity, isn't it? We're brought up with this idea that somebody will sort us out from the outside in rather than from the inside out.
Going back to my grandfather, you know, I can visualize now going to his home and bless him, he had prostate cancer. And seeing this whole, I think there was about 20 different pill containers on his mantelpiece, you know, and his wife was trying to tell him when he needed to take which pill and so on. Really, that is not the answer. For any chronic condition, there are much, much better ways. And many of them I have now discovered, not only through my own primary research, conducting, for example, a lot of experiments with human blood and music, which we can talk about, you know, either today or another time, but also digging very deeply into the scientific literature, into the medical literature, to find out what other people, other researchers are, you know, investigating in different countries around the world. And as you mentioned right at the very beginning, this new medical textbook, which is actually now under preparation, I've already written my chapter for it. Several other authors have written their chapters for many different aspects of medical work. And this is literally going to be published this year. And this textbook is an initiative by the European Union. So it's backed by major money. Mm-hmm. They're taking it very, very seriously. So these are alternative methods of alternative modalities. Instead of the mainstream modalities, these are, all of them are alternative. And sound therapy and music medicine are still, you know, at this stage classed as alternative therapies. I believe that one day they will become mainstream, but right now they are alternative. But isn't it a wonderful initiative to think that this book, this textbook, is going to be put into the hands at the European Union's cost of thousands of MDs all over the world, you know, who are going to be reading about these alternative methods. And hopefully, you know, there will be a reaction among many, many MDs around the world to start using these modalities instead of drugs. This is all drug-free medicine, basically.
Right. I mean, the timing of this is really extraordinary, you know, when you actually think about what the whole of humanity has been through over the last couple of years, particularly. And just the whole notion that it might be regarded as a new form of medicine, when there are you in the Egyptian times, you know, you're way back there, you know, within a healing vibrational context, which is thousands of years old.
Absolutely, it is indeed. And it actually strengthens my belief that ancient Egyptians did indeed use sound as medicine. And, you know, I had thought about that many times traveling in Egypt with my daddy. But you know, having had that actual experience, whenever we have an experience that really changes our life, of course it makes us really think about the potential for how it could help humanity in other ways. So we have to then consider that, all these different ways. But so, just for example, talking about the ancient Egyptians and their healing tools, just recently I came across a wonderful quote in an Egyptian text concerning the use of the sistrum instrument. And you know this rattle that the Egyptians used? The women in particular use this. I have one here. I'll just give you a quick rattle if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
So that's an Egyptian sistrum. And it you know, consists of little tiny, like little tiny cymbals, really, that are clanking against each other and creating these beautiful high-frequency sounds.
It sounds like cicadas, or, you know.
It does a bit, yeah. Anyway, I came across this quote in an Egyptian text, and it's talking about the festival of Opet, which I knew about the festival of Opet, but what I didn't know was that at this festival of Opet, The Egyptians would use their sistrum instruments. I think the plural is sistra. Anyway, they would use their sistrum instruments and rattle them in front of a person's nose, okay? And and then they talked about the healing attributes that came from this sound. Now, when I nearly dropped the book, actually.
Wow.
I was so excited about this because part of my research concerns the methods of using vocal sounds and indeed immersing ourselves in music from a therapeutic point of view to create nitric oxide in our paranasal sinus cavities, right?
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, yes. Nitric oxide is an extraordinarily important molecule in the body. And one of the ways that it helps all of humanity is by vasodilation. So nitric oxide actually dilates all of our blood vessels, helps the blood to flow, you know, more smoothly, and therefore also brings more oxygen to all of the tissues and therefore more healing, right? So it's a cascade of events, but basically it, where nitric oxide is created is primarily in the paranasal sinus cavities. And what is needed to create nitric oxide in the paranasal sinus cavities? Well, one way is simply to breathe through one's nose and, you know, keep our mouth closed, breathe through the nose. And whenever we breathe through the nose, that also, that will produce a certain amount of nitric oxide for sure.
Yes.
But if we use high frequency sound, like the Egyptians did with their sistrum instruments, then the paranasal sinus cavities, these little tiny cilia, in those cavities actually are what is responsible for creating the nitric oxide. So let's think of talk about how we, you know, what sort of sounds we make that would create these high frequencies. Well, one, of course, is singing.
Yes.
You know, because when we sing, of course, even if we're singing quite a low pitch, let's say we're a man and we're singing quite low frequencies, or let's say we're humming, right?
Which humming, I was going to say, very strong.
Usually pretty low frequencies, right? But when we think about the low, well, or low pitches, let's say, in a humming, active humming or singing in a low pitch, then, of course, although the center frequency, the fundamental frequency is low, there's a whole range of harmonics. These are multiples of that fundamental that are going way up into the, you know, high frequencies. And so even in a simple low frequency singing or humming, we are creating beautiful high frequencies that are exciting our nasal cavities. And one way to do this is simply to place your little finger, the tip of your little finger, very lightly on the side of your nose. One, doesn't matter which side, either side.
Yeah.
And then make a hum or make a low frequency sound, a tone. And you will feel your nose literally vibrating with those high frequency harmonics. And so that's how we know, you know, for sure that the sinus cavities will produce these, will produce the excitement needed to create the nitric oxide, right? Well, the Egyptians knew this. I mean, how they knew it, they probably didn't know about nitric oxide. Let's be honest, you know, that's not realistic to think that. But what is realistic is that they knew that it had health benefits to excite the nostrils in this way. And so I find this extraordinary to think that the ancient Egyptians had this knowledge and that we're only just now rediscovering it. You know, I mean, it really is astonishing. But also, I'd like to share it with your listeners, if I may, this business of how was I healed, you know, all those years ago of this very, very debilitating pain. So this comes back to my research with human blood, actually. It's 4 years ago now, I conducted some research with Professor Sungchul Ji of Rutgers University. He came here. He's actually the father of Seiya Ji. And Seiya Ji is the man, he's the man behind greenmedinfo.com, which is probably the world's largest natural health website. It's a fabulous, if any of your listeners are not familiar with it, I definitely highly recommend it. Anyway, greenmedinfo.com.
But absolutely
his daddy, Sungchul Ji, he came here And together we conducted some really amazing work with human blood. And the purpose of this experiment, this was a hunch that I'd had many years ago, Chloe, that music would have some kind of an effect on the longevity of red blood cells. That was the kind of basic hunch or basic hypothesis.
Right.
And
right.
So we conducted a series of experiments, literally with recorded music. The blood was placed in a little incubator in the lab here. We played music to the blood, but we first of all had tested the red blood cell count before we started the experiment. And what we did was we took a vial of blood, warmed it up to, you know, normal blood temperature, 37 degrees C, decanted that into two smaller test tubes. One of these test tubes would go into the little incubator in the lab here with a small speaker. Yeah. And then the other vial of blood would go into our Faraday cage, which is actually, it's a small room that we have in the lab here. It's electromagnetically screened, but it's also extraordinarily quiet in there. It's like 25 dBA for those listeners who know what that is. Really, really quiet. Anyway, so that's kind of the control blood. And then, of course, even before we started, we did the control test to find out how many red blood cells are viable, your blood red blood cell count. Then we conduct a test, and the test simply consisted of exciting the blood with music from a small speaker, as I mentioned, placed in the incubator, for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. This was the protocol that Sung Chul Ji had actually decided upon. He said it was require 20 minutes minimum for a biological effect. So that's what we did. And by a strange coincidence, that was exactly how long it took for my lower back to heal in the all those years ago. Well, actually, it's not a coincidence. I'm about to share, it really is not a coincidence, because what we found was we tested many different genres of music with this experimental setup. And mm-hmm. we found with every single genre of music, regardless of concert pitch, whether it was 432 hertz pitch, 440 or 444 pitch, all of the concert pitches that we tried, all of the different genres of music that we tried, in every single case, returned far more viable red blood cells than from the control in the Faraday cage. Way, way more, right? Every single time. But what was really counterintuitive here was that the least red blood cell count, even though it was still pretty good, but the least was from classical music.
Oh, interesting.
That was really interesting. So that really got our attention, because we thought, well, why is this? Why is it that the classical music, is it that the red blood cells somehow know they don't like classical music? You know, anyway, no, that's not the answer. You know, the answer is the bottom line is, and again, to cut this, you know, quite short, the answer is that the low frequencies in the music, genre of music, whatever it is, but the low frequencies are what powers this mechanism. And the mechanism is as follows. You know, in your circulatory system, in your body, you have a heart, of mm-hmm. course. The prime reason you have a heart is to pump blood around your body. It is essentially a pump, right?
Right. But
what is not generally known is that the heart has a secondary function. And this secondary function is to create low frequency pulses of sound. You know, when if you put your ear against someone's chest, or you hear your own heart through a stethoscope, it's got this really beautiful low frequency pulsation. Mm-hmm. Well, that is low frequency sound, of course. And what happens in your bloodstream is that those low frequency pulses of sound cause the oxygen, which is dissolved in the bloodstream from your normal respiratory system, that oxygen, it's causing that oxygen to bind to the hemoglobin molecules in the red blood cells. If you don't have pressure pulses, then no binding can happen. So in other words, you know, if your heart stops, well, we all know what happens. If the heart stops, we lose consciousness within seconds. Even though, if you think about it, in your brain, where there's, you know, a huge amount of blood engorging your brain all of the time. And so when the heart stops, Even though that blood in your brain is fully engorged with oxygen, you will still black out. You still lose consciousness. Why? Mm-hmm. Suddenly, no more low frequency pulses of sound. Suddenly, no more ability for the hemoglobin to bind to that oxygen. So you have to have the low frequency sound from the heart to cause that effect, right? And here's the answer, really, to why the red blood cells were so stimulated from low frequencies in not classical music, because classical music has very limited low frequency register, right? Most classical music. But if you think about all popular music has a kind of throbbing bass beat.
Yep.
And that throbbing bass beat is literally mimicking what our heart does. If we're immersing ourselves in popular music that has this low frequency pulsating beat, mm-hmm. and if we're listening or experiencing that music, full body immersion, literally from speakers, then those low frequencies, those low pitches, let's call them, in the music will deeply penetrate our whole body and cause more oxygen availability to the hemoglobin molecules. Literally, it's like a heart. It's mimicking what your heart does, right?
Yeah, that's fantastic. So there's a message for humanity right there.
And this is how my back was healed, literally. Very quickly.
Yeah.
Mechanism. What happens, you know, when we have a spinal injury, however, wherever in our spine we injure it, our body has a remarkable mechanism that kicks in. Mm-hmm. And it's got various names, but I'm going to call it for the time being the splinting ability of the back. Spine. What this means is that your body will automatically go into a spasm in your spine. The muscles will literally spasm to protect the site of the injury. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate aspect of this, although it's a really clever mechanism, the kind of downside to it is that it causes so much more pain than the original injury. So the original injury is painful in itself.
Yeah.
But your muscles go into these spasms. Well, I think everyone knows, you know, when we have a cramp, what that feels like, a cramp in a leg, you know, for example, a big muscle that goes into cramp. Oh my goodness, it is so painful.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
The reason for that pain, Chloe, is because when the muscle starts to contract in that way, it squeezes out the blood, even in the little capillaries in the muscles. Mm. All that blood is squeezed out. So we now go into a situation where it's hypoxic. There's no oxygen available in the muscle to feed the muscle. So the muscle doesn't like that.
Right.
It seizes up even more. And when it seizes up even more, then it squeezes out even more blood. And so it's a cycle. And so a cramp is extremely painful, right? Well, it's the same spasm in your spine is a similar kind of thing to a cramp. The muscles are literally doing this to protect the injury while the injury heals. So when I entered the pyramid, this is what I hypothesized happened for me all those years ago. In the 3 weeks leading up to this research mission to go out to Egypt, the healing had, this is hypothetical, the healing had already largely happened, okay? It was already natural healing in those 3 weeks. But the body had not yet switched off this splinting cycle. This splint was still in very, very much intense and was still causing me huge pain. But as soon as I went into this low-frequency sonic environment in the King's Chamber, now, remembering what I just explained about this music blood experiment, the low frequency register in the music causes the hemoglobin molecules to bind to the oxygen, right? So in other words, it's immediately making more oxygen available in your bloodstream and in your tissues. So in my case, in the Great Pyramid, as soon as I created these low frequencies, my body would become engorged with oxygen. You know, all of the tissues suddenly had far more oxygen available.
Yeah.
And so this splint in my spine, we can think of it in the consciousness terms, it suddenly said to itself, we don't need this splint anymore, guys. You know, we can release this splint now because the healing has largely taken place. we can release it because all of this oxygen is suddenly available to us. Just let's release it. And so literally within 20 minutes, no pain. It was like a miracle.
Goodness me. But I mean, doesn't that, that's a real message, isn't it? Not only for music, to really demonstrate the medicine of music, but I mean, imagine bringing that into all primary schools, that understanding what impact that would have on absolutely everything that was going on. If this kind of music medicine was the kind of ground of education, for example, all children were given and provided with this understanding, yes, you know, of this low frequency sound, how that would impact attention, intention, motivation, you know, aliveness.
All these snobby people who are, you know, pushing classical music to children, you know, I mean, I understand because obviously I love classical music, but I'm making a bit of a joke of this. But nevertheless, you know, people who are snobbish about, well, not necessarily classical music, but who are snobbish about popular music, right? Let's say, then to learn that popular music is actually mimicking one's heart and causing all of this wonderful healing effect. So education, you're right, Chloe, education is the key. And you know, my main focus is certainly on educating MDs all over the world into these new technologies. But I also, I'm writing a book currently as well with one of my hats on, but I'm also interested in children in terms of, you know, educating children. So
they'd love it. They'd absolutely love it. I mean, because it'd be so natural for them already. Yeah.
Well, I would love to write a children's book after I finish, you know, the other book that I'm writing. Yeah, so it's very exciting.
There's so much to talk about, of course. It's just absolutely a massive area. But in terms of the impact of what you're describing on human consciousness, you know, that in other words, you don't have to be this kind of passive individual, just kind of being pushed around through life on all sides and, you know, being told what to do in whatever, you know, in whatever domain you're in, you know. I mean, that whole idea of medicine coming from specialists from, you know, who've been trained in that area to provide you with cures from the outside in, and you're totally passive. We're brought up to be completely passive in that area, in the same way as we're brought up to be passive about music. You know, I mean, the number of traumatized people that I've met over my life, you know, who basically, you know, you ask them, how do you feel about your voice? They say, I haven't got one. I haven't got a voice. Well, what do you mean? What does that mean? Oh, I was thrown out of the choir. And these traumatic stories, which sound quite trite at one level, but impact the human psyche, the human soul, in such profound ways. And then you're also making me think of being in Pisa at the Green Tara Monastery with these incredible low-frequency mantric Tibetan, Mongolian, you know, mantric singing and so on. That must be some innate understanding there of the power, of the medicinal power of sound there, and how, of course, so many people in recent years have gone in their droves towards indigenous music and so on, which is much more grounded in rhythmic and rattles and all of that to bring in that high frequency.
Earlier, I'm not sure whether it was actually in this chat that we're having or whether it was before we began the chat, but I know you mentioned Christine Stevens, for example, and her rhythmic drumming. No, here's a prime example of what you're just talking about there. The drumming sounds, which, you know, have been around for thousands of years. Obviously, the drum is one of the first, if not the first, musical instrument. Now that we know that these low-frequency sounds from drums are actually mimicking what our heart does. Yes. Wow, I mean, it's astonishing.
My God, it's absolutely something. Everybody should have at least one drum. This should just be a cultural invitation, really, to absolutely everybody to remember this and to take it on. It's absolutely profound, the area that you're covering here, and there's so much more to share in terms of how ordinary human beings, how we all shift our awareness about what true medicine could possibly be.
Right, and you know, coming back to nitric oxide and the sinus cavities, the paranasal sinus cavities.
Right.
One of the aspects to this that I think needs to be, we need to educate people that feel that they can't sing. I mean, you I know this has been part of your life's mission to encourage people to sing. However, there are some people who, however much encouragement we give them, they will never, you know, attempt to sing. They're too shy, they're too inhibited, or whatever the reason is. But when it comes to production of nitric oxide in their bodies, which is so important from a health perspective, then the good news is for these people who just are too shy or whatever reason they don't want to try to sing, the good news is that if they listen, if they experience music through speakers as opposed to through headphones, then what's what I call the passive effect of nitric oxide production, not only in the paranasal sinus cavities, by the way, but also in lungs out there, because the lungs also produce nitric oxide, not as much as the paranasal cavities, but still they do produce quite a lot of nitric oxide. And in both cases, you know, we're talking about a volume of gas, right? So your paranasal sinus cavities are quite a small volume of gas, air, we're talking. And the same is true of the lungs, but obviously just a larger volume of gas. They're still an enclosed volume of gas. And this is what is termed in scientific terms as Helmholtz resonance. So in other words, when you have any enclosed volume of gas, that enclosure, like say like a balloon, for example, will always have a prime resonant frequency, right? And so will your lungs, and so will your paranasal sinus cavity. So in the case of your lungs, depending on whether you're male, female, what size of chest you have, and so on, the frequencies will be in the ballpark of 100 hertz for a male and up to about 150 hertz for a female, still quite low frequencies. But when we talk about the paranasal sinus cavities, then we're talking frequencies that are anywhere between 1 kilohertz, 1,000 hertz for a male, up to about 2,000 hertz for a female.
Wow.
Now, when we immerse ourselves in music from speakers, what happens is, through the principles of Helmholtz resonance, those cavities in your paranasal sinus cavities will automatically select the prime resonant frequency out of this myriad of frequencies in the music. So it happens automatically. You don't have to do anything really except immerse yourself in beautiful music. And the same thing then happens with your lungs. Your lungs will automatically become excited at the low frequencies, you know, whatever is their prime low frequency. And therefore, even people who are too shy to sing, just immersing themselves in beautiful music is something they can do for their own health that is really, really beneficial. And I love that idea that we can, you know, we can create nitric oxide actively if we like to sing or hum, but we can also create it passively just by immersion in beautiful music through speakers.
Oh, beautiful. Well, John, I am so grateful to you. This is so rich and so, you know, as I say, it's such an imperative area for people to be understanding, not only just the joy of music, but understanding what's actually happening physiologically to you and why it is, you know, you're not only just having a good time, you are actually really giving yourself, you know, a whole new breadth of life to experience. So we probably will close at this point, but I just would love for us to continue this conversation, you know, in the future. And I think really what you have demonstrated to us is the compassionate power of sound. Also, for us to have, from what you've shared, such a much more conscious awareness of how the connection between compassion and sound, how those two realms are made for each other, really.
If we get another chance to chat, Chloe, I'd love to talk about the vagus nerve and how the vagus nerve slows down aging. And, you know, looking at your photo right now, I can see you look so young. No wonder, you know, because you've been exciting your vagus nerve, stimulating your vagus nerve all these years and sing. And so, yes, I think that's something that most people would be interested in, to know how they can slow down the rate of aging.
Beautiful. Well, let's do it, John. I mean, let's absolutely do it. That would give immense pleasure. I know, not only to me, just to continue this conversation with you, but to, you know, so many others. And it's, as I say, it's such a time for this. Yeah,
I would love to do that, Chloe. And, you know, and it is, as you say, it's a very important time in history of humanity, to be able to spread this kind of knowledge. But also just the fact, I mean, the whole point of me gathering this knowledge across this last two decades has been to share it with the world. And so this is a wonderful opportunity, you know, through your podcast to be able to do that, Chloe. So I'm very, very grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a great, great pleasure and honor for us to be able to hear this and to be able to spread the word more widely for you and for this incredibly important. I mean, imagine people just understanding that they're not just simply enjoying themselves. You know, this whole idea of music is just this lighthearted entertainment thing that you do when you finish work. You know, it's actually an integral part of life itself.
Absolutely.
That literally is a full-time occupation.
Powering the healing mechanisms in your body, you know, this is, it's just so important.
Yeah. Bless you, dear John. Thank you so much for session one, should we call this?
Bless you, Chloe. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you. Thanks to you. And every joy with your course with the Shift Network as well.
Oh, yes. I'm really looking forward to that. Actually, again, you know, it's sharing knowledge, and I just love to do that. What greater joy can anyone have but to share what they know?
Well, it occurs to me that because you're starting that quite soon, here we are in March.
Yeah, the course begins on the 23rd of March.
Oh, great.
I think the way it works is that people can join the course late. They can't, I don't think, right up to the end, but they can certainly join it up to something like the middle of the course, I think.
Yes, I think you're right.
Because, of course, all the replays are available, aren't they? So people can catch up from the replays.
Right. I wish you every joy with that. I'm just so happy that you're doing that. It's brilliant.
Thank you, Chloe.
To be continued.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you. God bless. Till the next time.
Bye-bye. Thank you.